Okay, we'll get through that. Michael, are you going to take us through?
We're going to start, we've got a couple of, well, three interpretation committee related issues, followed by the IFRIC update, and Denise is going to start us off with the role of a...
Hello. Agenda paper 12A presents the recommendations from the Interpretations Committee to amend paragraph 57 of IS 40. This paragraph provides guidance on transfers to or from investment properties. These recommendations are the result of the discussions that were held by the Interpretations Committee in January 2015, when it analyzed an issue on whether a property under construction or development that was previously classified as inventory and then transferred to investment property could be analyzed under paragraph 57 when there was an evident change in use. So to address this issue, the Interpretations Committee recommends the ISB, as I mentioned, to amend paragraph 57 in order to reinforce the principle for reclassification into and out of investment property. And the amendment would state that a change in use would involve an assessment of whether a property qualifies as an investment property, and this should be supported by evidence that a change in use has occurred. And also the Interpretations Committee proposes that the list of circumstances set out in paragraph 57A to D should be represented. The purpose is to say that this list of circumstances are just examples of evidence that a change in use has occurred. So we have concluded that this list in paragraph 57A to D is not exhaustive. So other facts and circumstances could be also included as evidence. Finally, the recommendation is to add a disclosure to paragraph 75 of IS 40 as paragraph 75I to ask an entity to describe the evidence used to support the change in use for each transfer to and out of investment property. So we are asking this in this paper whether you agree with all these recommendations made by the Interpretations Committee. Thank you.
Thanks, Denise. I agree with where you get to in terms of the change to paragraph 57, but I just want to make sure I understand. My recollection was that the Interpretations Committee thought that, as written at the moment, 57 is an exhaustive list because it says when and only when particular types of sort of evidence have occurred. So the proposal is really to say when and only when there's evidence of a change in use, and then to have these examples of the types of evidence,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
So I agree with that. In terms of the proposal to have a specific disclosure requirement to talk about the evidence that you obtained to sort of justify the change in use, I'm not sure if I'd agree with that in the spirit of our sort of move to try and be less sort of checklist-based in terms of our disclosure requirements. So we don't. If I had a look at IS 40, and I didn't think we had a requirement before to disclose why or how you determined that you should move categories, and I wasn't sure that just by sort of changing the emphasis in this paragraph, I would have thought that we needed to change the disclosure requirement. But was the thinking of the committee the fact that because we're now less prescriptive, that it made it more relevant to describe the evidence? Was that the logic?
Yeah, I think the logic was to, because we are reinforcing the principle in paragraph 57, by adding a disclosure, we are saying, well, you definitely need evidence that the change in use has occurred, and we are asking entities to describe this this evidence in a note. As you say, it's not currently in IS 40, but it's something that we are suggesting.
So I think it was partly to balance against a concern that a company shouldn't be able to make this reclassification on a whim, if you like. It has to have been a change has occurred. So just to reinforce that.
Doesn't this, if your change make that clear without then having to go the extra step of saying?
And I guess that's the challenge that Sue is raising.
Yes. I'm not sure I'm convinced.
Amaru.
I have the same similar point as we stressed. I agree with the clarification. I think the limits, the limitation that is today is inappropriate. But when I go to the second suggestion to change the disclosure, in particular the use of the word each transfer, so this will bring pressure again on the disclosure overload, because then people will interpret that, well, in this case, materiality doesn't matter.
Yeah, of course it matters.
So, no, I know, we know that, of course, matters, but whenever we use each transfer, it's apparently over doesn't consider the materiality. So I'm not convinced of the second suggestion.
Martin?
I was on the same page. I mean, I agree overall, but with this disclosure, I don't agree, because I think it is more or less a disclosure if that evidence really has happened. And for me, it is more, maybe the auditors should look at that, but it is not really a useful disclosure for users, and therefore I think it will lead to disclosure overload, and I don't see really the usefulness of that disclosure other than maybe to prove that, but for me that is more documentation internally which has to provide to the auditors instead of disclose it in the financial statements.
Mary?
Again, same 2 points, maybe a couple different spins on them. No objection to the proposed narrow scope amendment that's being planned in general, in terms of being clear to permit or actually require the reclassification when there has been an actual change in use. Agree with emphasizing the principle that you have to follow the change in use. Like others, I am concerned with kind of doing a disciplinary disclosure approach, and I guess I'd, since this is being led by the interpretation committee, would ask that you go back to the committee and say, is there a particular problem in this area that makes you think that such a disclosure is needed, when normally we wouldn't do that as long as we're clear that the principle is there has been an actual change in use and not just a change in intent. It may be related to the difficulty when it's under construction, but even if that's the case, I think if we make the make it clear that there has to be evidence that belongs more in the standard rather than the discipline. The other thing that struck me, and it kind of goes back to whether this is resolving diversity in practice or addressing what people think is an inappropriate limitation in the standard, is whether this needs to go ahead as a separate minor scope amendment, because to me it's, on the basis of this paper, it seems to be more a clarification where there's diversity in terms of understanding whether that when and only when language modifies change in use or the list of circumstances specified. If people view this, if there's a single reading that says it limits transfers to the list of specified circumstances, but here's the practice problem, that's too narrow, that suggests that they need the change to align with what should be the principle of actual changes in use. But if it's just a clarification, I would be very much minded to suggest that this be included in annual improvements instead of tracked as a separate narrow scope amendment, because it seems a very narrow issue and one that I wouldn't think needed fast tracking. So do you know, is it more arguments that there's diversity in practice and this is to resolve, or it's everybody reads it narrowly but think that's not appropriate?
Yes, well, in the paper that we presented to the Interpretations Committee, the staff originally proposed an annual improvement. Mm-hmm. However, during the discussion, the main point that was raised was that there was diversity in practice, especially in many countries in Asia. So there was widespread diversity in practice. And then, well, they decided that it should be better to do a narrow scope amendment because of this diversity. I think I would agree with you that we are really clarifying the content of the paragraph. We are not really eliminating anything substantial from the paragraph.
Again, I don't want to undercut the Interpretation Committee's kind of lead responsibility with these. So I think I'd phrase it as, could you go back and say that the question was raised at the board, if there is diversity in practice now, so this is a matter of confirming it, and we're confirming it the way they want to propose shouldn't we just hold it for the AIP?
But I think they already did have that discussion.
Yeah.
They've had that discussion.
Yeah.
Yes, they have.
They said there were different readings.
Yeah.
Differences in the emphasis to the point
you raised. But to me, if there are differences in reading, that reduces the need to fast track it. I'd say give them that feedback, and then I wouldn't object to whatever outcome they have. This is the outcome.
But let's not do all this back and forth.
No, that's why I said just give them that and see what they decide, and I'd go either way. But
Philippe?
Could you clarify for me what is the effect on property under development, incomplete property? Because if you say change of use has occurred, seems to imply that the property is already being used. And by definition, an incomplete property under development cannot be in use. It will be used. So if we say has occurred, we seem to prohibit any change in classification before the property is put in use. Is that the intent? Or was it not to make it possible to change classification for property under development? And then I don't think that the notion of has occurred, the change in use has occurred, works with property that cannot be used before it is completed. So it seems to me we are unnecessarily restricting or conflicting with the objective by using the terms has occurred.
Well, investment property is property that is held for capital appreciation and or for rental out. Now, I agree, if it's under construction, you can't be renting it out to somebody.
Or using it.
Or using it, but you could nevertheless have taken the necessary steps to start identifying how you're going to find somebody to rent it out to, made that formal decision at the board that you're now holding it for capital appreciation and...
But let's take the other example. Initially, I develop a property for my own use, my office building, headquarters. Subsequently, decide it will not be used for that purpose. I want to classify it to investment property. I start putting that on sale on the market to get some tenants. But the change in use has not occurred because I've never been using that property yet.
I don't think you would necessarily say you've not changed the use.
Well, intended use. But you see to prohibit a change based on intended use by saying has occurred, which implies, I think the wording issue, if we say intended use has changed and there is evidence of that, I'm fine. If we say it must have occurred, it seems to be prohibiting any intended change in use, even though you have evidence for that change. So be careful about the wording has occurred. I think it doesn't work always. If you interpret it in a narrow way, it doesn't work. If you interpret it in a wider way...
But at any one particular point in time, in order to qualify as investment property, you must meet the definition of investment property.
Wow.
And so that, for me, would be the key test.
Under development. I don't have only investment properties which are completed. I can have investment properties under development.
Absolutely. And this is to enable you to make that classification.
So think about my point. Has occurred seems to prohibit that classification until it is completed.
Daryl?
I took some comfort from your answer to Sue's question because it seemed to resolve the problem I was having with this, but we seem to have wandered away from that point. So I just want to perhaps bring it back to the question. My reading of 57 is 57 is explicit. It's if and only if, and it's evidenced by, and it gives a list of four. And it doesn't in any way to me represent examples. And so when I read this paper, my first comment here was that view A, as it's expressed in the paper, is not a valid view from an interpreter's perspective. That meant when I thought about the change, and I agree with the direction we're taking, I didn't see this as a clarification. I saw this as a change in what the intent of the standard had been, or a change in what that section meant. And I'm comfortable with it in that context. I'm very concerned if we start to say that the words when and only when there's a change in use evidenced by and an absolute list ever means that that list is examples, because I think that can be applied in other places in our standards. So I would want us to be very clear that we are, although we may have had a principle and we're comfortable that the new articulation is a better articulation of the principle, I don't think we should say we simply clarify in the previous paragraph. To Philippe's point, I was in terms of thinking about what the had meant in this context, I would have thought that if I'm constructing a building, and at some point in mine, instead of actually building the building for my use, I start building the building specifically for a tenant's use, that is evidence of something that has happened that indicates I've changed my mind. So I think you can get it during the building process. You don't have to wait until you have an occupation of. And I'd be looking for that sort of evidence as opposed to intention.
I agree with intent and I agree with outcome. I just think that the notion of has occurred is not easy to apply, because just the fact that you start marketing that building to get tenants doesn't mean a change in use, a change in future use. Decision as how you will use it has occurred, but not the change in use. So, Swarthy.
Pat? Michael, I just want to clarify, the reason why I was in favor of question two and the disclosure, because in my mind it tied into the idea that when, in fact, you make this type of transfer, there's an income effect, okay? So you want to tie it out to the P&L. So just as we have an IFRS 9, a requirement to disclose the effect moving securities from fair value P&L to cost, and you effectively want to be able to predict what earnings are going to be going forward, if, in fact, you're going from an investment property status where you're at fair value, you're seeing changes in fair value flowing to P&L, now you're going to go to a different status. That's going to affect your ability to make future projections of earnings and maybe even cash flows, depending on the disclosure. So unless this is flagged, I think it's going to make it more difficult for somebody to go through that exercise, unless you can point me to paragraph 75 or somewhere else where that is going to be disclosed. Otherwise, then I don't have a problem with it. But if in fact, you're not going to get that, then I think it's fair game to put that in there. We're talking about material transfers, obviously.
But then you should disclose that a change has occurred, but not the evidence.
Yes.
It's a different thing, I think.
Well, that's my question. Is there a requirement to disclose the change in the income effect? If there isn't, then I think it's appropriate to disclose the rationale.
Mary?
Based on Daryl's comment, withdraw my suggestion to ask again at the Interpretation Committee if this should be an AIP. It sounds like it's an amendment to change, and let's not mess around with that.
Okay, so can I see if we agree with the question one, that this principle should be reinforced?
Subject to drafting.
Subject to
the
drafting.
The emphasis should be changed.
The emphasis is going to be changed, yeah?
Yes.
On the
all
win
in
and
win. 13 in favour.
And can I see who is in favour of the disclosure?
Four.
So we are against. And who is in favour of it being done through a narrow scope amendment? Okay, Denise, next paper.
The objective of agenda paper 12B is to ask the ISB if, again, we can discontinue another annual improvement cycle. Well, this is the case of the annual improvements to IFRS 2014-2016, because at the moment we only got two issues, one on IFRS 1 and another one on IS 28. As explained in the paper, and we would like to ask if we can initiate a new annual improvement cycle. It would be the 2015-2017. In this new cycle, we will carry forward the two amendments that we've got already on annual improvements, and any other amendments that might be approved during the year.
So it's more like a triennial improvement cycle.
Yes.
Yep.
Do we agree?
I'm concerned about the IS 28 one. I understand that it's causing quite a lot of problems in practice, and I think delaying what is a simple solve or simple solution from our side for something that is actually creating a bit of havoc in practice does worry me a little bit. And I think this would cause us to postpone it quite a long time, wouldn't it? I mean, so essentially people are sitting trying to decide how they do this right now, and a lot of the audit firms seem to be viewing the wording that is in IS 28 the opposite way to where we intended it and the opposite way to the way we're saying it here. And this would just prolong that problem for a lot longer for, as I say, what seems to be on the face of it a very simple solution.
Amaro?
I think, consider that Dario's comment on IS 28, my question to staff, if we consider that this is fundamental for us to do as early as possible, would it possible to do through a narrow amendment in the 28 case?
Well, I think that would be, if you want to accelerate this amendment, maybe you could propose a narrow scope amendment, perhaps?
I'm hearing dial concerns on 28 and the level of diversity on this particular aspect. So instead of carrying forward to the next annual improvement, is there any other way for us to take care of this?
I guess there are two things that we could do. One is we could put it out as a separate amendment, but given that we've already assessed this as being something suitable for annual improvements, the alternative would be simply to not postpone these two items and put out an ED of annual improvements with just these two items in.
That sounds a good idea. Okay. Do we agree with that amendment? That we're going to put out the...
So we won't postpone, we'll go ahead and put this out with the two items.
Do we agree with the staff's recommendations?
Well, no.
That's
not the staff recommendations.
That's not the staff recommendations.
The orally articulated one right now.
Okay. Including this.
Yes.
Proceeding with it.
Okay. All in favour?
Akemi.
The agenda paper 12C explains the technical measures agreed by the interpretation committee and the due process followed to date for a draft public interpretation accounting for uncertainties in income taxes. The draft interpretation would provide guidance on measurement of current and deferred tax liabilities and assets when there are uncertainties for income taxes. The draft interpretation does not limit the scope to any specific situations. However, it would not always require an entity to reflect uncertainties in measurement, because an entity would reflect an uncertainty in measurement only if it is probable that the entity will pay or recover an amount for the uncertainty. The draft interpretation would also include guidance on determination on units of measurement for uncertainties and on assumptions for tax authorities' examinations to ensure comparability among entities when this draft interpretation is applied. The draft interpretation would not introduce any new disclosure requirements, but explains the existing relevant disclosure requirements. The due process followed is presented in Appendix A of this paper. We have four questions for you, as presented on page 11 of this paper. First, do you intend to object to the release of the draft interpretation during the future balloting process?
Does anybody intend to object?
I just struggled a little bit to reconcile paragraph 14, which I think is the paragraph that says you must use the expected value or the most likely amount, with paragraph 19, which seems to say that you must throw aside expectations of viewing the information from the perspective of the authorities. So you assume, if you like, there's 100% expectation that they will see everything. Now, is paragraph 19 referring to whether or not you should look at the thing, but when you get to paragraph 14, you must take into account your expectation of the probability they will look at? Or does 14 actually the expected value, but assuming 100% probability that they will look?
14 assumes 100% probability they will look at it. So the assessment you're making there is your assessment against what you expect the interpretation of the tax code to be.
Okay, and does that then mean that if I take that then and combine it with paragraph, I think, 24B, which 24A and B, which deal with prescription, that if I'm an environment where the tax authority never prescribes, then that liability remains on my books forever?
Yes.
Not necessarily, because you do look to see what decisions the tax authority has taken in looking at your tax returns. So whilst they may continually have a right to go back and re-inspect, if they've looked at it, they have either implicitly or explicitly accepted what you have submitted, then that is relevant information that you can factor into your judgment about how much.
That then suggests, so if I assume, let's say, there's a 70% chance that having had a full inspection, that they may actually charge me or implement a tax on that amount. They come along and they have a look and decide not to, but I don't know how properly they've looked. I don't know whether they've had a full-on look at that, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, if I still have got 100%, I've got an assumption under paragraph 14 that I must make a 100% assumption that they can look again, that they will look again. That's what it seems to be saying, that look can happen in perpetuity. How do I ever get away from my 70%?
The fact that they have looked at it and they have accepted or implicitly accepted your position is a relevant fact, and so you would take that into consideration.
So I wouldn't adjust the 100%, but somehow I must adjust the 70%.
Yes.
Would this also apply to any taxes or interest on these amounts, or are those covered separately under 37?
This would apply to amounts that are within the scope of IAS 12. So to the extent that you've got other amounts which are not within the scope of IAS 12 because they are not income taxes, this interpretation would not apply.
Do penalties on income tax, are those income tax or those separate?
We haven't addressed that issue in this interpretation.
But they are not generally treated as tax.
Generally they're not, no.
They are generally treated under IAS 37.
So essentially it's the circumstance I may have here is if, for example, let's assume the tax man doesn't look at a particular transaction, but it also doesn't prescribe, I would keep that transaction on my books in perpetuity, but I would assess the tax, I would assess the interest and the penalties under 37, and at some point I'd probably conclude that he's not going to look, so at that point I would then not have interest and penalty, but I still have the tax.
That's my understanding.
Paragraph 14 again. So the Interpretations Committee think that it's understandable when you would apply most likely amount and probability weighted expected value because it's understandable in revenue recognition. But this is quite a different situation from revenue recognition. So why is it necessarily transferable to this? And do they therefore know when you would use most likely amount and when you would use expected value? What are the circumstances present in taxation that would point you to one or the other? Because I don't know.
I think this judgment could be a bit difficult, but we are planning to provide some illustrative example to facilitate the judgment. In addition, actually, in practice, some entities use the expected value or the most likely amount, so we expect that an entity can choose the appropriate amount for each case, but probably we can ask for comments during our future comment period.
Akemi refers to some examples that we have in drafted and included and been reviewed by the Interpretations Committee to illustrate circumstances where you are using the expected value and others where you're using the most likely amount.
And what is it that drives you towards one or the other?
If there's a single term and it's a binary outcome, then that would be the most likely amount. Whereas if you've got a large population of similar items, then an expected value approach might be more appropriate.
Is that second situation ever going to arise in taxation?
Yes, I think so.
You may have different entities being examined by the tax authorities. You may have a group examination, 20 different entities.
Yeah, but it would be correlated across the whole lot. The point in revenue recognition is that you don't have that correlation and therefore the expected value makes sense.
So, yeah, and if you've got a number of similar transactions subject to the same area of tax code, again, it would be a reasonable approach to take the expected value.
Well, I don't think so, because if you've got 20 transactions and you either get a relief or you don't get a relief, all 20 either get the relief or don't get the relief. And therefore, the expected value is no different from the expected value for a single outcome. We say don't apply the expected value to a single outcome because you know it's the wrong answer. It's either the binary outcome. But if you have a portfolio of items which are all correlated, then again you have the binary outcome for the portfolio and the expected value still as well. I struggle to think of any... If you accept that expected value is the right answer, then you do whatever. But if you accept there are some circumstances where expected value is the wrong answer, because it's a binary type situation and you want to go for the most likely, then I don't see in taxation circumstances where you would support expected value.
I'm not sure whether this could be helpful, but to interrupt the interpretation, we provide a bit more guidance to determine which method should be used. So now we plan to explain that the expected value may be a better prediction if possible outcomes are widely discussed with lower probabilities. Okay. And in other cases, maybe the most likely amount should be useful.
Can't you have still a situation where, for instance, the tax authorities inspect your business expenses, travel, entertainment, and you have a number of items which are possibly will be challenged, and you say maybe this expense 100% chance it will be rejected, that one 10%, that one 20%, we would have an expected value approach for a not identical transactions, because they are all specific cases, but a kind of transactions, a series of transactions, which may be for some of them accepted, so for some of them rejected, or for some of them just half of it is accepted.
Okay, I mean, I'm just...
Business lunch, five people, I accept only two. And the three, it was company people, they are not allowed to have a tax deduction.
So you want to...
All I wanted to say, Steve, was I'm sure that the Interpretations Committee would be very happy to get some input on the drafting on this, yeah. Because I think, from my recollection, most of the discussion from the Interpretations Committee was really about whether or not there should be the inclusion of this more likely than not amount approach in IFRS, and the decision was made to not to do that because we don't have precedent for that, unlike under US GAAP. So they're focusing more on this, whatever is the better way to predict the amount that will pay or recover, then what they did to try, with an objective of being helpful in their defence, was to try and pick up what they saw as our most recent articulation of that, which was an IFRS 15. But if there's particular circumstances that we think should be brought out to decide what might or might not make sense, given the tax environment, I'm sure they'd be very welcome. They're not trying to sort of opine in some radical way that we haven't discussed before.
Yes, thank you. I agree with Sue, you know, because on this expected value, most likely you are giving us a better prediction of the what circumstances. So I guess there's no big problem. But my concern is related to the paragraph 23. There are some issues about the statute of limitations. There are big discussions, but you are going to place this discussion in the basis for conclusions. It seems to me that's dealing with this issue too lightly, because as Daryl said, you know, this is a kind of big concern from perspective of our users. So I recommend you or reconsider your decision whether to include this part in the body of the interpretation rather than in the basis for conclusion.
Okay, with these comments, does anybody intend to object to the release?
I'd like to see the wording.
Okay, we'll get it back, I suppose.
Yeah. The drafting.
Are we satisfied with due process steps?
Yes.
All in favour?
Do we agree with a common period of no less than 90 days?
All in favour.
And does the staff have permission to ballot the draft interpretation?
All in favour.
Thank you.
With us?
Every report, sorry, every update.
Oh, okay. Every update.
Thank you.
Okay. Paper 12D is the IFRIC update from the March 2015 Interpretation Committee meeting. There were four items I just wanted to highlight for you. First of all, on page 2, there's the description of a number of issues we've been looking at in IFRS 5 and non-current assets held for sale. We've been looking at a number of issues there over a number of meetings. We will continue that at the May meeting, but my expectation is that we will bring a paper to you at some future meeting summarising the committee's discussions on this with a recommendation as to how to take that forward, whether it should be through some clarifications or whether it should be through some sort of broader consideration of IFRS 5. The second item is on page 3 and our work on developing a draft interpretation on the interpretation of paragraphs 21 and 22 of IAS 21, which is to do with proposing guidance on determining the date of the transaction for the purposes of foreign exchange. The Interpretations Committee reached a stage where they felt they had reached general agreement on what that draft interpretation should say. So we'll be bringing to a future meeting of this board a paper similar to the one we've just done for IAS 12, setting out the committee's conclusions on this and proposals, and asking you if any of you object to the publication of a draft interpretation. The third item was to just flag on page 4, there's a description of the work that the committee had done at the last meeting in the follow-up to the exposure draft that had been published last August relating to deferred tax assets on unrealised losses. This was a narrow scope amendment that you had published an exposure draft of, but that had come initially from the Interpretations Committee, and so we took those comments that we'd received from the outreach to the committee in the first instance to get their input, and they're supportive of recommending that you do finalise that amendment, but with some suggestions on how to improve the wording further from what had been exposed. So we'll be bringing you a paper with those detailed recommendations to you for your consideration at a future meeting. And just finally to highlight, from page 6 onwards, we've got 9 agenda decisions that were finalised at the March meeting, 7 of which relating to IFRS 11 on joint arrangements, which concludes the committee's work over a period of about 14 months, looking at various issues to do with joint arrangements. And So that's culminated in this guidance that the committee has put out in the form of agenda decisions following a 60-day comment period, as is the norm for agenda decisions. So those were things I just wanted to highlight, and then to ask if you've got any questions on those or any other items in IFRIC update.